Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for June 24th, 2013. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast in which I share the long-promised interview with Dr. Pamela Gay. First, so just to let you know that due to just how my day has unfolded and the length of the conversation, there's no new hacker word of the week this week. Also, before I get into the interview and even just some preface of the interview, I finally, on literally the last day possible for the project to send it to me and make good on the commitment they made to all of the pledge backers on their Kickstarter campaign, the folks at Ouya finally got me my console. I set it up just a little over an hour ago. I haven't had much time to play with it yet. I might do a more in-depth review of it. So far, it's impressive. I think there's some obvious rough edges that still need work. I haven't had a chance to download and actually play much, but so far the experience has been very seamless and very pleasant. I look forward to digging in a bit more to inform a more sustained conversation about something that I've believed in from the very start. And I think no matter where it is now, I think it has a massive potential to disrupt a space that's long overdue for disruption when traditional console prices still are multiple hundreds of dollars. Game prices are still dozens of dollars. A game console that's $100, entirely open in every way imaginable, in every way that's important. It just plugs in, it just works. All of the games are free to try, if not completely free to play, and the preferred price points are much closer to what I think makes sense in terms of a little bit of an afternoon's or weekend's entertainment. But as I said, more on that later. First, though, the interview that you'll hear coming up, I think it turned out fantastically well. I was happy to give this woman an opportunity to geek out in a way it sounds like she doesn't always get a chance to geek out about. She has so many passions, which I think come through very clearly in the course of the discussion relating to her, the focus of her work, astronomy in particular, planetary science, but also as a science communicator, someone who's been podcasting just a little bit longer than I have and makes such wonderful use of all of the social and peer media at her disposal in order to not just do that work, but to educate, to collaborate, to reach out. I'm very happy to give her the opportunity to talk about, as I said, the sides that maybe she doesn't get to indulge in as much, the big data, the tooling, the software, some of the things that overlap so much with the things that I talk in about week in and week out on this show. And honestly, again, as you'll hear in the interview, any excuse to have her back on, whether it's the one we talk about or we find some other aspect of her work that you all might find interesting. I hope that you enjoy it as much as I did recording it. And without any further ado, we'll just get right into the interview. For those like me who listen to science-focused podcasts, Dr. Pamela Gay may be a familiar name as she has been a fixture there, from her initial work on Slacker Astronomy through to Astronomy Cast, which she co-hosts with Fraser Cain. A strong theme of her work is education and outreach, to which end she has innovated and explored the application of all sorts of new media. Her most recent development in that arena is securing early access to Google Glass on the promise of using it as part of her ongoing work in science communication. As if all of that were not fascinating enough, what has become very clear in the various conversations I've been privileged to have with her over the years is that she is very much a hands-on techie, working with a lot of familiar tools from the open source world to all of the amazing ends I've described from her work generally. Welcome to the show, Pamela.
Hi, Thomas. Thank you so much for having me on.
Of course, I have to start, given the very clear focus of the work that you do and the communication work that I described. So why astronomy? And in your case in particular, it's not even just astronomy, but planetary science.
The why astronomy, I think, goes all the way back to being one of those geeky kids that like to go out and freeze to death in the backyard trying to find where that smudge of Andromeda was hidden between the stars. And today, the why planetary science, in large fact, has to do with the technical challenges I get to work on. My research areas have always been variable stars and extragalactic astronomy, where I was doing image-based work. But I am cursed with an ability to attract clouds that few other astronomers have ever experienced. The great thing with working with satellite data, with spacecraft data, is there's not many clouds orbiting the moon. And if there are, those are great things to study for science.
So you touched on something there, something I wanted to dig into about your use of tech. And just trying to tease out if it's inherent or that's a very conscious choice that you made. Just maybe this is a little bit more background on your field. Is it very much a part of your focus of study, or was it one of many options that you faced in your course of study?
Observational astronomy today is very much a software-driven, technology-driven field, but how much you get under the hood really is really defined by what you want to do. When I was a graduate student, I was working on trying to find galaxy clusters hidden in survey data taken by radio telescopes. So I was writing software to plow through the tens of thousands of things in two different surveys, trying to find the things that aligned and then matching them with cataloged objects in X-ray catalogs and catalogs of known objects. And so I became a database junkie. And once I started programming, it was kind of hard to stop. And at the same time, I was a graduate student trying to afford a horse, which is not something you can afford, of course. So I did web design on the side, trying to pull in money for hay and grain. And what I found as a grown-up, I guess, is when I got into podcasting, all of that HTML work, all of that then CSS work, all of that PHP work, it just kept going and going and going. And then as I encountered scientists who were trying to do database-driven science without having any clue how to handle a database, they needed someone to write that website access that would allow them to manipulate their data, annotate their data, and then also get other people to do those things to their data, because there was just too much data for them to handle, even with great database software.
For the benefit of the audience, what's always struck me in our conversations is that if you subtracted out the fact, if you occluded the fact that this was the primary driver that you described so well about parsing and digging through this data in particular, you sound in a lot of ways like a lot of the other open source techies that I hang out with that are concerned with designing MySQL databases and writing a little ETL code and doing transformations and interesting sort of analysis. So that's one thing that I want to emphasize and make clear. And I think your explanation about how you found some interesting sidelines to fuel your outside interests is fascinating. In that context. But also, I that leads me to wonder that interaction that you had with other scientists who maybe still had interesting questions, but maybe not the experience or the skills to dig into the data the same way. Does that have anything to do with your focus as well on science communication, as opposed to just sticking to your own research?
I think that's actually just a nice coincidence. Being able to communicate astronomy is being able to communicate science in general is its own language, its own sociological skill set. Being able to program computers is its own inherent dance with a foreign language of ones and zeros. And I've been lucky enough my entire life to have grown up with computers and to then always be getting pushed towards more literary careers for whatever reason. So I grew up being trained in here's how you do speeches, here's how you do writing, here's how you become an excellent communicator. While I was going home and hacking a database in eighth grade so I could track Battlestar Galactica characters for the fanfic I was writing. So I like took this to a new level at a young age. I remember in middle school as a project, I'm just going to give away way too much. I did a Battlestar Galactica fan fiction project for one of my gifted and talented student classes. And I wrote my own special effects using Terrapin logo, where I managed to get it to turn the turtle into a viper and fly it around. And so I've just always been combining. There's the nerd side of my head that's the techie nerd, and then there's the nerd side of my head that's the science nerd. And there's this little person desperately trying to pretend to be an English major sitting in between.
There are two thoughts I want to follow up on. One, a bit more humorous, and then we'll dig into, I think, something a little bit more serious after that. Well, the first is really just knowing some of the people that you hang out with, Fraser Cain and the larger circle of folks that you hang out with, that some of these folks actually ended up consulting on the new Battlestar Galactica.
I know, Kevin Grazier.
Did that just make your head completely explode, that was like so much a part of that story of like your early adoption and interest in technology, and then sitting there going like, I'm sitting at a table with a friend of mine who's actually a consultant on the new series.
Well, the day that I almost... No, let me rephrase that. I did lose my cool on the inside, but I was a deer in headlights, so it didn't appear that I lost it on the outside. Was back in 2009, we were trying to raise money for the International Year of Astronomy, and Kevin Grazier, who is the science consultant for Battlestar Galactica, he's like, come on, let me take you back to the green room for the Battlestar Galactica cast, and we'll get them all to sign one of the boxes. And I got to meet Richard Hatch, who was one of my first crushes when I was a little kid. And then the actor who played Colonel Ty in the new version, he comes back into the green room and he sees me holding the Galileoscope. And he's like, is that a Galileoscope? And he had a total science geek out moment because he recognized the Galileoscope. And I, my inner dialogue was like, he knows what it is. He knows what a Galileoscope is. And on the outside, I was just like deer in headlights. All of the, why, yes, it is a Galileoscope. Let me tell you about our program. I don't know where all of the poised words came from, but lots of training. That's all I can say is part of my brain went on autopilot while the rest geeked out.
I remember the Dragon Con that same year where you were talking about the Galileoscopes, and I have to say that I think you must have just had a lot of practice because you were very poised and very clear and very compelling in talking about that as well. Can you, for the benefit of the listeners, maybe back up a bit and describe what the Galileoscopes were for people who may not otherwise be familiar?
And luckily, what they still are, this is a program that still exists. It's just not as big as it was. The original goal was to try and design a telescope that could be mass produced and sold for $10 a telescope plus shipping. They never quite got there, not because the design wasn't that good, but rather because people never ordered them in large enough numbers that you need to get the costs down that low. But it's a telescope that is made so that if you drop it down the stairwell, it'll pop apart, all the pieces will scatter, and then you put it back together, and it's fine. It's perfect for kids. It has plastic lenses, a plastic body. But the optics are so good, you can make out the rings of Saturn. We've had top optical engineers from companies like Teleview look through it, and they're just kind of awed at the quality that managed to be found. So it was this moment of some of the top optical engineers that build professional telescopes partnering together to build a telescope designed for kids. They donated their time, and it's still available at galileoscope.org. And now, if you buy them in bulk, you can get them for $25 a scope plus shipping. And in fact, tomorrow I'm going to be doing a teacher professional development workshop with teachers from the East St. Louis school system, and each teacher is going to get a telescope for free.
That's fantastic. I hadn't realized that it continued. And also, well, I mean, as a geek parent, I'm fascinated both by the fact that the optical qualities of the Galileoscope are so impressive, but also where you started with that, especially raising two boys, that they are a lot more rough and tumble, that it is something that's that sturdy. But I want to dig into next a little bit more. You know, you said, I love the way you said that you were kind of like an English major sitting there somewhere in the middle, that a fair amount of your work actually is at this very interesting intersection that we've talked about, the data and the programming skills, we've talked about the communication skills, but I think there's another interesting social aspect that you've been involved with in what a lot of people are calling citizen science. So can you explain maybe a bit more about kind of your background there, and especially your current work, and why it is, and I think this is really the key question that I'd like you to dig into too, that I think you probably get asked asked a lot, so maybe this is a bit of a softball, of how the things that you're doing with the volunteer efforts really can't be automated away with just a little bit more software or clever computer code.
Well, there's a lot of different science questions that you can only answer either by looking at tens of thousands of images or taking tens of thousands of images of one object. And both of these types of questions offer different types of challenges that scientists can't handle on their own. I started out in astronomy studying variable stars. These are stars in the night that can sometimes double in brightness over the course of a few hours before fading back to where they started. And if I go to an observatory director and said, hey, give me 180 nights to study this one telescope, this one star with the telescope, he's going to laugh me away. But if I go to a whole bunch of amateur astronomers and say, hey, will all of you go out and look at AH Leo? We're going to do a project that's going to take about 10 years. They'll say, sure, let's do it. And that's kind of where I started, with studying these stars, where we really do rely on amateur astronomers. And we have been for over 100 years relying on them to go out night out after night with their personal telescopes. As I got more advanced in science and started to learn more of the things that were getting done, I realized there are all of these problems out there that are the other side of this problem. Instead of needing to acquire all the tens of thousands of images, that you just can't get the permission to take that many images of one thing with a professional telescope. The problem was we had things like survey satellites that were orbiting the moon, survey telescopes on the surface of the Earth that were taking image after image after image. And while we could write computer software to do things like find all the objects of a specific shade of blue and thus find all the white dwarf stars, what we couldn't do was write software to say, find all the fuzzy blobs and then figure out if they have spiral arms and then figure out what direction they're turning and classify them. The software that tries to do that, maybe 50, 60% accurate, if it's lucky. Then there's problems of trying to find craters on surfaces of the moon, Mercury, any rocky object in our solar system. Soil comes in different colors, shadows move as the sun appears to move in the sky. All these things add up to, again, computers can only be maybe 70% accurate. But if we want to do the detailed science studies, we need bigger samples, we need higher levels of accuracy. And humans come with built-in pattern recognition software, and we've learned how to plug this wetware into our algorithms as just one step in the data processing module of what we do.
What impresses me about that in particular, though, is that I think that a criticism that could be leveled against a lot of sort of crowd intelligence or crowdsource efforts is relying too much on the crowd, that you actually have experience dealing with experts, that there are people who spend months and months and months and months of their time, using the example of identifying and quantifying craters, who are expert at that. And you guys actually have developed some very compelling narratives around how averaging the results of crowd inputs and coupling that actually somewhat counterintuitively and surprisingly with some good filtering and some good algorithms can start to approach a very clear, well-established benchmark. So it's not all of one thing or all another. And I think that admits room for, like, I saw a story in the last couple of days about, I think, an Australian research team that was doing, like, some subsurface mapping of lunar craters that was kind of fascinating, that may not be, at least in the first pass, as accessible to the citizen scientists. But the work that you're doing suggests that there are ways to kind of blend and take advantage of the strengths of both to be far more effective than either alone.
We actually just finished submitting a mammoth journal article. It was over 19,000 words. I've never been part of a journal article this long. And what we did was we quantified the accuracy of the public compared to a group of professionals. We, for the first time, and I think it kind of shocked all of us, but in all the decades that people have been mapping craters on various rocky surfaces, no one ever sat down a group of professionals professionals, made them all look at the exact same field and compared their results. And we sat down 8 different professionals. We had them go through multiple techniques, in some cases using the software they use every day, using our software in a couple of instances, compared their results. And the first neat result was when we looked at the 8 of them using their personal professional software of choice, the median of those results pretty much matched the result of the 2 individuals who used the software we built for the public. And they actually said our software in some respects was even easier and more pleasant to use because it was a less cluttered, more straightforward interface. So we know our software works. And then the next question was, well, if we get a bunch of members of the public together, how did their results? And what we found was any one individual member of the public wasn't as good as any one professional. That kind of makes sense. They're not going to mark everything. They're going to get up, wander, go get tea. Lots of things are going to play into that. But if you get 15 different professionals to look at every image, their aggregate results are going to match within all error bars the results from the professionals. And that was kind of awesome. And you're right, it required a whole lot of software because we were dealing with problems that your general friends of friends algorithms aren't designed for. We had to deal with the fact that we weren't just searching for clusters of points in X and Y. We also had to deal with the fact that you could have a small crater inside of a large crater. So we had to add that third dimension to how we did the sorting and clustering without inadvertently ending up with n cubed for how we went through our algorithms. I'm not saying we optimized it for the best, but we have software that now runs in hours instead of weeks, which is where we started.
I think that's worth emphasizing the fact that you mentioned as a part of this work that you're building your own software and that you had experts actually reviewing that. And it may not be as powerful. And I joined the live hangout that you did just this past weekend. It might be a little bit further past by the time the listeners hear this. But hearing some of the experts that you've been talking about actually give an honest assessment of how the software that you built in the way that you work actually stands up pretty well to some very sophisticated, powerful packages. Now, granted, stuff that cost a whole heck of a lot more and actually serves. I have some experience with ArcGIS, which is one of the packages mentioned that serves a wide variety of mapping needs, and that you're able to approach this and with more modest resources, much more targeted to the work that you're doing, come up with something that stands up pretty well.
And I think that this is all due to the fact that we have a programming team. It's just 3 of us right now. It's Corey Lehan, my lead programmer, who's someone who loves math. That's his passion. Then we have Joe Moore, who's really our front end guy. And in his heart of hearts, he's a video game guy. He thinks all about the user experience. And he's able to take that thought about the user experience and a deep-seated sense of sarcasm and apply them to making sure the interface makes sense. I'm the person who's in there who understands the astronomy data, but also has the annoying sense of color where if the yellow is wrong, I'm going to fix it. And we all come to this with the programming chops to be able to help each other when any of us get stuck in an algorithm of doom. But we also come to it with a different sense of aesthetic that allows us to build really awesome things together as a team.
Well, and I think the results really speak for themselves. I was struck by seeing you present your work at an admittedly informal venue at a science fiction convention, but you bringing that same earnestness and professionalism in the communication there that you do when you're doing much more serious things, but really bringing it down to the visualization. So we talk about that comparison between experts and the combination of some of the algorithms that you guys have worked on with the crowd inputs. And being able to put up a visualization that just makes the differences very clear, that you don't have to belabor it, that it is visually appreciably very close, definitely proves out the value of the way you guys are working.
It's sometimes all it takes is plotting your circles to make a point that you could try and say with numbers all day long, but seeing is believing.
So there's one last thing before I let you go that I wanted to dig into a little bit. Something that I've talked about on this podcast, a recurrent theme, are alternate business models, but usually in service of creative projects. So video games, books, film projects, and the like. You're exploring crowdfunding for scientific research. Can you provide a little bit of context? And I know that this is maybe a little more challenging. We'd like to live in a world where we're not dealing with issues of sequestration and how they actually affect such amazing work. But can you provide a little bit of context and explain how this came about, how some of the things that you're considering drawing from the world of Kickstarter and social media and the like, some of the innovations that you're applying to what I think is honestly a very a novel field to be applying them to?
Well, I guess at a certain level, we're returning to our roots, just less regally. And that sounds very odd, but it's actually the truth. Astronomy once upon a time was something that was paid for by kings and rich lords. And if you were an astronomer, you were someone who existed to amuse with your intellectual ability to understand our universe. Astronomers answer the basic questions. Where did we all come from and how's it all going to end? And often that's not the type of thing that treasuries of nations want to spend their money on. We got lucky for a while. For a couple hundred years, there were science programs scattered all around the world that would invest in paying for astronomy, would invest in advancing science. And in the age of the space race, this became key to us. Well, as I heard it put the other day, we won. We got to the moon first. I'm not sure we won yet. I think the battle's still raging. But it's a good one to rage if you're going to fight over anything. Seeing who can learn the most the fastest is a good thing to fight over. But during the time of Sputnik, during the time of Apollo, money got shoveled into advancing our scientific understanding of the universe. And that is stopping. That is slowing down. Money's getting reinvested in other directions. And as we look to the next budget the president has put forward, it actually zeroes the funding for science education at NASA and many other divisions of the federal government. And I don't want to die due to a zero getting added to a NASA budget. And so I decided, let's go back and say to the people, we're here to answer your questions. We don't exist to answer those questions for the 1%. We exist to answer those questions for the 99% and the 1%. So help. We're going to try in the future to transform our funding model to one where we're looking for corporate sponsors and foundations, but help us bridge to that tomorrow. Help us with $10, $30. Over the weekend, we ran a hangout-a-thon, a telethon using Google Hangout on Air Technologies, and we ended up bringing in a little over $23,000 when everything was said and done, and the median donation was just $30. And that makes me stupidly happy that so many people out in this world donated a night out with their spouse for dinner to help fund science. And all I can say is wow and thank you, but we have a long way to go. I run a very small team that does everything from getting telescopes to teachers to getting science online that's leading to 19,000 word science articles. And we cost $200,000 every 6 months. So we're a little over 10% of the way to where we need to be.
There's another parallel here that I want to tease out, hopefully something that you would consider maybe a cause for optimism, that I do like the historical callback, and that makes sense, certainly when we talk about the patronage model, but scaling that out to the individual rather than the privileged makes a lot of sense. And especially when we talk about this sort of research, something that should, as you so well put it, be accessible both to the 99% and the 1%, that it can be as simple as the cost of a meal, of making a simple decision of this is important to me. Understanding, as so many other science communicators in your tradition have put it, you know, the preeminent story of why we're here and what the universe is all about, that can scale down in mass to something so achievable, and that you share that so freely and so generously. I think that that's, I know it's not the best catalyst to come to this place, but I think that that's an amazingly positive silver lining to think about.
At the end of the day, the universe is an amazing place for all of us to explore together. And it's that key fact. All of us together are needed. It takes a village to raise a child, but it takes a global community to raise our understanding of our solar system and beyond. And with citizen science, we draw everyone into that exploration. And we're hoping that we can borrow your minds as part of our software algorithm. But right now, we're also asking for your dollars to help advance our understanding.
I think it's a fair trade and a fair request. And I want to give you some time before we close to just speak for a moment, if you will, about what's next. What else do you have planned that's coming up where people may be able to help out or may just be interested in what you're up to?
The next big project that we're going to be releasing is called Planet Investigators. We're waiting for the data to come to us from the Hubble Space Telescope. It's an archive project where we're going back and looking through all the images that have been taken of the various planets and asteroids and other rocky bodies throughout our solar system. And we're looking for the things that weren't the scientists' primary science goal. So they might have been observing Neptune to stare at its moons, and we're going to stare at its weather. So we're looking at weather, we're looking at moons, we're looking for asteroids that might be sneaking through the field when no one was looking. So we're trying to uncover the science waiting to be discovered in these images that are in the archives.
That sounds utterly fascinating. Can't wait for an update. Maybe we'll have you back on to talk about that some more as that unfolds. If you want more information about what Pamela's up to currently, I highly recommend you check out cosmoquest.org and absolutely check out the donate page to that ambitious but well worth it goal that she's striving for. Thank you so much for joining us, Pamela.
It's been my pleasure, Thomas. Thank you for having me on.
That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed the program, please do tell a friend. Or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all the ways you can financially help out with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net. Or you can post those as a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If you need to get in touch with me securely, details of my public key pair can be found at thecommandline.net/gnupg-fingerprints. The next episode, which should go out in the feed next week, will be a newscast as usual, so until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. The views expressed on this program are my own, and where applicable, those of my guests, and in no way reflect those of my employer or anyone else. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Except where noted, permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits, and you share your changes under the same license.